Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power and shine a light forward to where the evolution is taking us. Well, water is life. We've heard that so many times it almost sounds like a cliche, but it is so true. And not only do we humans require water for ourselves, but every human endeavor does as well. Agriculture, energy, industry, business, recreation, whatever it is, a river runs through it, a spring feeds it, and as Swami says, we humans, without water, we're sunk. Even the cloud requires water, because the more information being stored and used, the more water is needed to cool the servers. And as we know, uncooled servers are just not cool. So the good news is, if we humans work together to manage our most precious resource, that's W-E, because we share it, we also create the pathway to manage every other one of our collective problems. Our guest this week, Jim Loria, is an engineer. He's a writer. He is a mind. Mind mapping master, and he's had a lifelong love affair with water. From his childhood in Queens, at a time when New York City was famed for having the best water in the world, to his travels as an engineer to countries across the globe, to his current mission, a book called "To Know Water Is to Love Water," Jim is a true hydroluminary, a term created to describe those who hold a piece of the puzzle that will provide clean and abundant water to all. While there are many clean water advocates out there, Jim's experience is very special in that he has spent his career actually cleaning water. As an engineer and now a VP of sales and marketing for Maisy, a company that makes water treatment and management products, Jim sees the big picture, and he also understands the practical details of turning the ideal into the real deal. I said earlier, he's an expert at mind mapping, and he's also an expert on Leonardo da Vinci, particularly that great genius's understanding of the science of water. So as we at Wiki Politiki look to find the sacred and the sane amidst the divisiveness and political polarization, water is maybe the one identical issue that all humans face beyond all the identity issues. So, Jim Loria, welcome.
Thanks, Steve. Really great to be with you today.
Okay. As I said earlier, you and I both spent our deformative years in New York City, and there's one thing we can take pride in: New York City water. So, why don't you tell us about New York City water, how it was, and maybe still is, and a bit about how you cultivated your own love for water.
Sure, Steve. Well, as you said, I grew up in Queens. I speak the Queens English, while you speak Brooklynese. You know, you grew up in Brooklyn, but we both shared the same. What I always look at was the watersheds of upstate New York, which allowed the water to be so clean and pure in New York City when we were growing up. And still to this day, it comes from up there. And, it gave me the idea about, there's always the saying, we all live downstream. Well, we just happened to grow up in an area where, being downstream, we had some really great water that was supplied to us. Very little filtration was required, very little treatment, a little bit of chlorine, but for the most part, it was pretty fresh as it started and continued down to New York City, which in large extent, made New York City a great place to settle when the Dutch came in the 1600s. It was recognized that the water there was pretty clean, and to this day still remains so.
Yes, that's real. It's really interesting. And how did you become? What was your first spark of curiosity about water?
Well, I grew up as a young child being interested in chemistry and science, and as you well know, water is the universal solvent. And so whenever I was doing my mixing and, you know, formulating, water was pretty much what was the medium I used to do all the kinds of experiments that I was growing up with. And as I moved along, chemistry was of interest, but for some reason I decided to be an engineer. Part of it was because of my love, as you had mentioned, of Leonardo da Vinci. My dad's Italian, the Italian heritage mixed in there. And I was very fascinated by his way of building things, of looking at how things were built, and you know, looking at his notebooks and understanding how he thought really sparked my curiosity and started my path towards getting my chemical engineering degree from Manhattan College in New York City.
Well, you know, here we are. You know, we're talking about water, and it's such a obviously, it's a deep subject. How would you summarize our current water crisis and opportunity? So we go meta right away here. So how would you characterize?
Yeah,
that's
right. Well, I think that you know, it's been well documented that we've got the same amount of water we've always had, and it exists in the oceans. It exists in the polar ice caps. It exists in rivers, lakes, streams. It exists underground in aquifers. And there's always been this recycling of water throughout the millennia. The problem is that we humans, we need water in certain aspects, certain ways, in order to use it for whatever, you know, functions we're trying to use it for. And when we use it, we materially change its nature, whether when we're using it to cool things, we raise the temperature. When we use it for farming, we add fertilizers and pesticides that end up going into the rivers and streams and creates problems of algal growth. We use it for industry. We use it for creation of natural gas and oil. It takes a tremendous amount of water to produce whatever type of energy we have, whether it's trying to get oil out of the ground. We use water to push it out with the natural gas as well. We use it to produce electricity in big power plants. We use it in nuclear power to create steam, to cool the core of the nuclear reactors. Whatever energy we're looking at, it's going to take some water. And as we use that water, as we humans use that water, we change its constituency. We contaminate it. We use it to flush our toilets as consumers and create sewage. So the idea is that we need to process and treat water for the particular use we're going to use it, and then bring it back so that if we send it back to the environment, it doesn't cause harm to either the fish, the wildlife, or to ourselves as we reuse it again.
Exactly. So essentially, water, there is no away when it comes to water. As you said, we pretty much have the same amount of water as we had, let's say, when you and I were kids, and yet the population of the world has doubled since 1960, let's say. So we have twice as many people. We have other enterprises and endeavors. And so where would you say we are collectively with around water at this point? Where are we?
Well, the biggest thing is, if you look at the use of water, it's the biggest use is for agriculture, to grow food, to grow fiber, in some respects to grow energy. And so that's where we really can gain the most by conserving and using it. And then probably the next biggest use is around industry, the energy, the production of whatever we're making. It takes about 100,000 gallons of water to produce a car. We talk about the footprint, our water footprint. And we in the developed nations, we use a lot more water than the people in developing nations just because we're bigger consumers. We're bigger consumers of food. We're bigger consumers of products. We're bigger consumers, as you mentioned, of technology. And so all that requires water. And if you look at, you know, from a food standpoint, the biggest users of water, if you go on the scale of things, probably beef is one of the largest users of water. If you were to put a, let's say, an 8-ounce steak on your plate, you'd be looking at 1,000 gallons of water, from the amount of grain that was grown to feed that cow to the processing, to the cow eating and contaminating the water that's there in the feed yard, in the slaughterhouse, to clean that, to actually do the slaughtering, to transport that beef after it's been processed to the restaurants or to your home or to the supermarket, wherever it might go. You're talking about 1,000 gallons of water. That's like 55 gallon drums of water that's sitting on your plate. And then from there, you know, pork uses less water, going down again, chicken, then fish. And the best way to be maybe conserve the most amount of water would be to be a vegetarian. And which isn't really the case in a lot of instances, but you know, it's being cognizant of the amount of water that's being used to produce any given product.
So, and of course, we also have the situation where manufacturers of many things, from agriculture to industry, haven't really been responsible about the water that they let out the other end and goes downstream to other people and places.
Well, one of the main reasons for that is the value of water. We don't value it. I mean, we as consumers, we let it run down the drain when we're brushing our teeth. We flush our toilets with clean drinking water in the United States. I mean, it goes, it's not just industry that doesn't value water. It's everybody that doesn't value water. And I think more people are understanding that. And, you know, you've got some really good initiatives by some of the bigger corporations to really look at not only their use of water in their facilities, but also in their supply chain. So the idea is companies like Coca-Cola are looking, how do we produce Coca-Cola, which is basically mostly water, some sugar, some flavoring, but mostly water. And how do they use and use their economic power to not only put pressure on themselves in their factories, but also on their downstream supply chain partners. So I think it's more and more that people are looking at it. We're trying to grow more food, more crops with less water. As you said, you know, we're increasing the population size, but we're producing, which we have to produce more food for, but we're doing a much better job than we did in the past in growing that same amount, that increasing amount of food with a lot less water than we did, you know, years ago.
Well, that's interesting. And I think that's heartening, you know, and it's also true that, as you said earlier, you hinted at, you know, we're using very, very clean water to flush our toilets. And so I'm curious, I know you know a lot about various water systems which allow purification for certain standards, but not to the highest standard because it may not be needed for that. Can you say more about that?
That's exactly right. I mean, we need to make sure that we don't treat water more than it needs to be treated. And that goes a lot to recycling as well. We're looking at a lot of countries. So you made mention that as I've traveled around the world, I've looked at water management practices and tried to benchmark that in my writing. And so, you know, you look at a country like Israel, who really advanced in the 60s the idea of drip irrigation. And drip irrigation to the point of using that so that you direct the water, not just flood a field, but direct the water down at the root zone so that you're dripping the water right at that root, and that's the only place that needs that water, the water that's going to be taken up by the plant. And what they've also done as time's gone on is to recognize that that water doesn't have to be drinking water. So they've taken their wastewater, and Israel has done a remarkable job of taking 80% of their wastewater and recycling that. And the next closest country is probably Spain at 15%. And the United States, we're at a paltry 5% of recycling our water, although there's been a lot of initiatives through the Water Reuse Association and organizations like that to really develop technologies that will be able to reuse water and treat it only to the level that it needs to be treated to. For cooling, you know, if you're using it in a cooling tower, again, it doesn't have to be drinking water. It has to be some level of standard so people don't get sick if they're exposed to it. So, you know, removal of pathogens, bacteria, viruses, things like that. But, you know, as far as the cleanliness of having it right to what we would drink, it doesn't have to be there for a lot of applications, both in terms of agriculture and industry.
Well, we're going to take a break very shortly, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about your adventures, and we'll also talk about some of the crises that we've had recently, like the one in Flint, Michigan. We'll be back after a few messages with Jim Loria, Water Hydro Luminary.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Imagine, it is the year 2039. A single corporation controls most of the world through genetic modification, food, and drugs. A senior geneticist's lover dies, launching him on a quest to take down the psychopathic CEO and the handful of elite families that control the corporation. The feature film Corporate Prey, based on the novel of the same name, points us toward a dystopian future where we seem to be headed. Huge corporations do largely control our farms and our pharma. And wealthy elites seem to be operating to the detriment of most humans. Can we reverse course? Can prophecy lead to prevention? Can a movie awaken enough of us in time? To find out more and how you can help bring this enlightening film to light, go to CorporatePrey.com. Corporate Prey. That's P-R-E-Y.
In the wake of a disaster, what one thing can you send that will help people the most? A blanket. A tent, a sandbag, a doctor. Actually, if you send a monetary donation, you send all these things. Even a small donation can make a big impact and can quickly become exactly what people affected by disaster need most.
In the wake of a hurricane, your monetary donation can make a huge difference to those in need. To donate, visit supporthurricanerelief.org. That's supporthurricanerelief.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Steve Behrman. You're on Wiki Politiki. We're back with Jim Loria, who's an expert on water. And Jim, I really appreciate your talking about things that are working. Like, for example, the amazing benchmark that Israel has created, and being so far ahead of the rest of the world in creating drip irrigation and recycling and reusing, turning dirty water into reusable water. Where else have you seen these kinds of breakthroughs that we can adopt here?
Sure, it's all over the world, Steve. You know, I travel as an engineer, speaking at conferences, and when I go, I try and stop at the different water treatment plants and industries. And so Australia is doing quite a bit of good work around saving water per person. They really had a mandate a number of years ago where they were in a very, very bad drought situation. And they went to the general population and just had them, hey, you've got to reduce your water footprint, each one of you individuals in Australia. And they did. They virtually cut it in half. And it was just a matter of thinking about it and, looking at practices that they were doing at the households. And so a really good example there. Another good example was Singapore. Singapore, because they're an island nation, basically, they were getting most of their water from Malaysia, and they recognized that a number of years ago that they were beholden to a foreign power for most of their water supply. So what they did was they made a concerted effort to go out and recycle their wastewater to the point where they were doing such a good job of treating the water that the water that was coming out of their wastewater plant that was being treated to high levels was even purer than their drinking water. And the chip manufacturers, the silicon chip manufacturers there, wanted that water for their processing because it was cheaper to purify to the high purity level that they needed than the drinking water coming out of the tap. So Singapore, a really great example of some of the things that can be done with treatment. I was invited a couple of years ago to speak at the Texas Rodeo. Now, can you imagine a guy with my Queen's English accent speaking at the Texas Rodeo on Israeli technology that was being used in Singapore? If that isn't a global conversation about water, I don't know what is. So we can find it everywhere, and no one has all the right answers. But if we try and find some of the people with some of the answers and put them together and learn from each other, that's how I look at it. I look at it as a learning experience and extracting good management practices from different parts of the world.
Is there any in this country, is there any organization that is really looking at comprehensive water policy and looking at the big picture? Does that exist yet?
Oh, there's so many. Some of the really ones that I'm involved with is the Water Education Foundation, the Water Environment Foundation, the American Water Works Association. There's just a lot of people that are looking at the solutions. There's from the nonprofit side as trying to raise money for other places throughout the world. There's water.org, which is something that's supported by Matt Damon. There's Water for People. There's many, many organizations that are looking for answers, whether it's through microfinancing or learning new technologies, sharing technologies. I mentioned before the Water Reuse Association is doing a lot of good work with engineers in my field to promote good dialogue around what can be done to take this water and use it, not necessarily for drinking, but for other applications.
So on a different topic, what happened in Flint, Michigan? What happened in Flint, and why has it taken so long to redress that situation?
Yeah. So a lot of things happened there. And first, a lot of unintended consequences. So it wasn't malicious what was done. It was done around saving money. But the people that made the decision really didn't look at the long-term effects that could happen. And basically, by changing the water supply from one supply to another, changed the whole chemistry of the water in the distribution system. And when that happened, you started what had been laying dormant for many years was released. So it released lead, it released some pathogens. I mean, it was a perfect storm in a bad way that allowed this to happen. And the real problem was the cover-up, as often happens, was no one wanted to take the blame that they screwed up and that they didn't really take into account the potential for harm, because, again, it was around how do we save money. And unfortunately, the people that suffered were the people that were downstream, and the downstream people were poor. They lived in poverty, and they didn't have neither the economic nor the political power to really fight back. So, I mean, it's an ongoing thing and needs to be addressed, and it is being addressed, but that's, in a nutshell, pretty much what happened.
Yeah, and of course, you know, we have the same kinds of things with the CAFOs, the cattle feedlots. We have the same thing with fracking and those sorts of things. And how do you address these issues where either there's no regulations in place, or the regulations are simply ignored. And these things go on and on and on, and you know, we're all downstream, but it seems that the ones who are most downstream are the people who can least afford to redress that, the poor people.
Mm-hmm.
How does that get addressed?
It comes down to legislation. It comes down to people voting. I mean, you know, they vote for the people that they feel are going to protect their interests, and so. You know, I'm an industry guy. I've been a CEO of a mining company, and I always looked at, okay, how can we do what's right for the business and also do what's right for the environment? And we're extractive creatures. I mean, human beings, we have to eat, we have to live, we have to use energy, and so all these processes take water, and the idea is that we have to treat that water to some level so that we can reuse it or send it back to nature. So there's no really real easy fix. Conservation, it's technology to treat the water to a certain acceptable level. And but if you just say, okay, well, we have no environmental limits, and it's all about the economics versus the environment, then that's going to be a problem. So, again, it all comes down to the will of the people. We're only as strong as what we say we want, and we can do that with two things. We can do it with our pocketbooks, or we can do it with our vote.
Good. Well, I think that's really that's the next area of exploration. How can we vote with our money, with our pocketbooks? What are some ways that people listening can go, you know what, I'm just one person, but I think I can do this? What alternatives are there to start with that?
Well, I said it initially, and you know, I'm not one, but you could be a vegetarian. I mean, if you become a vegetarian, you're immediately tremendously reducing your water footprint. Eat less red meat. That's another way you can do it. You know, low flush toilets, all the things in your house that can save water from you know, going down the drain.
literally.
literally going down the drain.
Yeah.
You know, the more efficient washes. You know, from a personal standpoint, I wrote every year I release on World Water Day, I write a blog about what human beings can do for reducing water. So another way you can do it is drive less. It takes a lot of water to to get that, you know, gas in your car, to produce the car, all those things take water. And if you think by driving a hybrid is less water, actually you're using, you know, less energy in a hybrid, but you're using more water because of the batteries and things like that. The other thing you can do to make sure that you're as one individual, you can recycle, because everything that you're recycling, whether it's paper mills use a tremendous amount of water to produce the newsprint, aluminum cans, tremendous amount of water to take virgin bauxite and turn that into aluminum. So that's another way. And of course, if you recycle, that means there's less things in the landfill. And if you are, have less things in the landfill, that means that you're creating less pollution, because when you have water running off the landfill heaps, that's water that's being contaminated by any number of things that's in that landfill. So there's a number of things we people can do to reduce our water footprint.
You know, the other thing that we mentioned briefly earlier in the show, and some people may not be aware of it, is that, you know, we imagine that virtual reality is just sort of this open field where everything is abundant. You're not really using resources, but it takes water to feed the cloud, doesn't it?
Exactly. So in these server farms, and it's interesting that they're called farms, right? And they do use a tremendous amount of water, because if you think about it, and everybody thinks of the cloud up in the air, right? So it's the cloud, which is kind of funny to me, because the cloud, what's a cloud? It's water, right? So in that cloud, as you tweet and use Facebook and LinkedIn and Instagram and all that stuff and phone calls, and that's a lot of electrons moving around. And when you move those electrons, they create heat. And in order to cool that heat, the most efficient way to cool that heat is water. So, you know, these server farms are using a tremendous amount of water. That's not to mention, that's just the software part of it. The hardware, there's like 60 minerals and metals in an average cell phone. You know, if you think of the silicon chips and the copper and the gold and, you know, the glass and the plastic and all that stuff, that all requires water to produce as well. So if you look at it from that standpoint, our modern days now are actually using a lot of water that we never used in the past. And so while we're saving water in some areas, we're actually using more water in areas that up until 20, 30 years ago, we never even thought about using water.
So really what you're talking about, because we're using water, and water is one of those resources that it's here, it evaporates, it comes back. We have to find ways of reclaiming the water, let's say the water that we use on the server farms to cool down all of these computers and so on. How can that water be reclaimed, or does it just evaporate?
No, it's used and it's cool. But now what happens, Steve, is that the temperature goes up. And so now what you have to do is you have to cool that down, because if you put that into a river or a lake or a stream, it's going to affect the ecosystem. It's going to affect the aquatic life that lives there. You know, they're not used to having that kind of temperature coming back. So we have to treat it. We have to cool it. If it picks up any contaminants, we got to make sure, if it picks up any metals or any things like that, we have to make sure that it's being treated to a level that's not going to affect it. A couple of cases in point. I mean, you got Toledo, Ohio. They shut down their drinking water plant because it's on Lake Erie, and the runoff from the agricultural fields, we're putting a lot of nitrogen, a lot of phosphorus on the fields, because we've rapidly increased the capability of growing food for the growing populations, as we said before, and that's because we've learned to farm using all kinds of different fertilizers to improve productivity, but we over-fertilize. And that fertilizer runs off into it ran off into Lake Erie, and you have a bunch of algae there, which are plants, and they loved it, and they went crazy. And they took over, and they released some toxins, which were detrimental and were very difficult to remove at the head of a drinking water plant. So they shut down for a while because of that issue. You've got the devastating issue down in South Africa, in Cape Town, where their reservoirs, because of a drought, has been greatly reduced. And over they're right on the ocean, and they could easily have put in a desalination plant, you know, a way to remove salt from seawater, but they didn't want to fund it. And they were afraid that they would not need the water that was funded by this desalination plant. They build it, and it wouldn't be needed. But as a friend of mine said, that's like buying fire insurance and then complaining that your house didn't burn down. But sometimes it does.
Yeah. Yeah, case in point. At this point,
yeah.
Well, we're gonna take a break in just a minute or so, and then when we come back, I think we'll talk a little bit more about Leonardo da Vinci, that other Italian engineer, and we'll have a chance to talk about some other very positive developments that are developing. This is Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki, and we'll be back with our guest Jim Loria after this break.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Barry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network. Presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the WikiPolitiki sponsors page.
I rescued Toes from my shelter in 2011. I love Toes because she's a lazy diva. Toes does whatever she wants, obviously. She's sleeping right now. She's so loving. She's so comforting. When I walked into the shelter, I knew right then that she was special.
Toast, Instagram star and shelter pet. Amazing adoption stories start in shelters. Start yours today. Visit theshelterpetproject.org to find a pet near you. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
Well, this is Steve Behrman back with Jim Loria. If you're not from New York City, we're talking about water, not water, okay? We've been talking about water the whole time, but really what we're talking about is water, W-A-T-E-R. Jim, you're working on this book that's called To Know Water
Yes.
is to Love Water. Say more about that and what you hope to accomplish with this book.
Yeah, so Steve, when you said that, I always laugh because, you know, I'm a journalist, I write. So in a big picture of things, I'm a water reporter.
A water reporter.
Exactly. So I think you mentioned in the beginning, growing up and being an engineer and being from New York City, I just grew up in the way I was raised and just my interests, I kind of saw water in everything. And throughout my career, I've traveled around the world. I've looked at it from a lot of different aspects. And I thought that I have this love affair with water. I understand it from a scientific background. I understand it from a social and cultural background, from looking at it from different places where I've lived and traveled. So I thought it would be important for me to really put this down on paper. I've been writing about water for many years, probably now going on 15 years, and collected these essays as we talked about my time in Israel, my time in Australia, in Singapore. Talk about the cloud. I just wrote an article about how the connection between water and Bitcoin, cryptocurrency. So whenever I see something, a book, a movie, anything that interests me, for some reason, my mind always goes to water and how that's connected to this issue. So I figured it's time to really take that and put it down on paper and connect the dots between water and everything else.
And where does our friend Leonardo da Vinci fit into this? You just wrote a really wonderful piece about Leonardo and water, and you've had interest and curiosity in his life. What's that connection all about?
Well, there's a lot of connections, as I mentioned before, his being an engineer, also his affinity towards mind mapping. Mind mapping was developed by Tony Buzan as a way to kind of show how Leonardo da Vinci used his notebooks and connected things. And so that's always been a fascination. But it all came together, I guess, just recently when I read Walter Isaacson's latest biography on da Vinci. And it really was really opened up to me that he had such this connection to water, from his first painting of the Arno River, to his final deluge drawings, which showed water in its turbulent nature. Even a Mona Lisa, if you look in the background, there's the Trebbia River behind her. So his paintings all were connected to water. And then a lot of his designs, like he came up with inventions long before they were even conceivable, like his conceptualization of submarines, of scuba gear. And just the way he studied water, he really was fascinated by water. He used it as an analogy, and so what I saw was that there's a number of ways that we can learn from him, some lessons we can take. So the first one is understand the science of water. You know, just it's an amazing fluid. And it's very unique, and it's really the basis on why human beings are able to exist on this planet, which we call it Earth, but really it's mostly water. Interesting thing. if we study the hydrological cycle, I mean that's a key part of understanding water, how the water falls from the clouds onto the earth, how it flows, used back around through plants and so on. He also took a systems approach. He always looked at, and his big thing about systems was the fact that he really compared everything to the human body. And I always like to take a look at the human body and water systems almost the same way. You know, you got the heart as a pump, you've got the kidneys as the filters, you've got the brain as the central processing unit. So he took that systems approach and always compared it to everything around him. And so we can learn a lot from that as well. Infrastructure matters, and this is a big issue, especially in the United States. I mean, infrastructure is crumbling, and a lot of it because it's unseen. You know, so if a bridge falls down, we see that. If a building's not standing upright, we see that. But most of our water delivery systems are underground. So we don't see how they're really really crumbling and aging. And so he drew maps. He had an understanding that he drew a map of Milan, and what he showed was that the residents should live above and separate from the industries and the wastewater that was being produced by these industries and the residents. And so he understood that really you shouldn't be close by to the waste systems, because of a lot of it is detrimental pathogens, bacteria, viruses, things like that, which we really didn't learn. And even now we're starting to understand it a lot better. He had a very big respect for the power of water. So if you look at water, flowing water is very powerful. And so he put it to work. He saw how you could use it to spin silk, to grind and mill flour. He understood that that power of moving water was really something that could be harnessed and utilized. But he also saw that it was, and he was a peaceful guy. He, you know, I call him, in my piece, I call him a hippie. You know, he saw the world through rose-colored tunics, as as I like to say. He always wore the tunics. But he also understood that water could be a military weapon. He weaponized water and cut off that if you cut off water from your enemies, you could really bring them to their knees. Another thing he said was we really need to invest in study. You know, he was a self-taught man, and you know he could have made a lot more money for himself if he created some masterpieces, but he oftentimes would just go out, and rather than do a painting for a patron, he would go out and he would study something that was of interest to him. And he really felt that that was important, to study for the sake of knowledge. And then his big thing was to pass along knowledge. I mean, he really felt that these things should be reported and passed down. And, you know, and it's important today as the aging people in our water plants are starting to retire, there's a lot of tribal knowledge there that we really need to pass down and make sure people understand what's going on. So, you know, those are the things that I think we can really learn from Leonardo, and that I wrote about in this this piece that I published just a couple of, probably about a month ago.
Can we, dare we say that Leonardo was a Renaissance man? Dare we say that? I mean, he
he was the original Renaissance man. So
yeah, to kind of define the genre, kind of like Bullwinkle defined the genre of cartoon moose, right? So what the model is really is, it's a model for learning, it's a model for curiosity. And you know, these are all of the it's so interesting that you can't have a conversation without using a water metaphor, you know, and you and I have been through this many times where no matter what we say, there's the flow of the conversation. There's, you know, all of these things.
You're going in depth. We're going to go into depth. Yeah.
It's a lot in of, depth. Exactly.
It's like, yeah, we're going to be going in depth in a conversation. So, yeah,
or all washed up and, you know, all that stuff. So clearly there, exactly, we have a perhaps even a spiritual relationship with water in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the religions around the world, and that's something we didn't touch on, but, you know, as I travel around the world, it's always been interesting to me to look at what the religions are. And, you know, water rituals permeate every stage of life, you know, from birth. You know, we have the baptismal baptism of the Christianity, where you're dunked in water. You know, the Hindus, they bury their dead on a funeral pyre in the Ganges. And so, you know, in Asian societies, the holiest water is the one that comes furthest upstream, and which makes a lot of sense because, you know, it's usually the purest. If it's upstream, there's less contamination. So You know, we've really taken a look at water from a religious aspect and kind of used it for these rituals and you know, we've made water a sacred thing, but unfortunately, in our everyday life, we don't treat it as much as we should cherish it. I mean, you know, the title of the book, To Know Water is to Love Water, comes from the fact that we really need to cherish water. And it's so important to us, we should cherish it and love it like we would if we were loving, you know, our family, our children, our spouse, whatever it might be.
Yeah, whatever we love, we want to take care of, obviously. And
exactly,
you know, we don't,
exactly.
I think
as you would say, Steve, if you love water, you would treat it right.
Yeah, we got to treat it right. So what out there do you find the most hopeful right now, the most promising indicator that we will actually as a species learn to manage wisely this our greatest liquid asset, let's say?
Right. Well, I don't think we have a choice. I mean, that's you know, I hate to be flip about it, but we have to. I mean, it's connected to everything, and we're starting to see some real breakdowns. I mean, a city the size of Cape Town, where they're saying that they're going to be out of water in April or May, that's you can't imagine that. I mean, that's unimaginable, but it's happening. And so I think we humans are adaptive, and we're creative. And I think if we can learn from each other, because like I said, you know, earlier, there are people that are doing it right, that are making some strides, but no one's doing everything right. And so if we can take a little bit from here and a little bit from there and kind of merge them together, I'm pretty hopeful that we'll make the right decisions. And, you know, the idea is that we have to value water. Water, people say it's a human right, should be free. That's true. But you know, it's not free to treat it. It costs money to treat the water. It costs money to distribute it, to create the energy around pumping it to where it's needed. So, I mean, we have to value it, and we have to see it as the resource that it is. And as we said prior, we have to realize that we don't have to treat it to the best possible level, the purest level for all its applications. We have to treat it to a level where we say it's good enough for this particular application.
Mm-hmm. That's a liberating thought, because it means that there's different levels of purity. Obviously, for making computer chips, we couldn't drink that water, right? If we tried to drink water that pure,
correct.
It wouldn't be that good for
correct.
Us.
That's correct. You get very sick. The high purity water, it's like 10,000 times more pure than drinking water, because they have to polish those chips and make them clean. But if you drank it, it would pull out the electrolytes out of your body, and it would cause you to get pretty sick.
Very, very interesting. Well, believe it or not, we're almost out of time. Is there anything else, if you want to leave people with something that an awareness? And by the way, I have to say that this book that you're working on, To Know Water is to Love Water, seems to be an attempt to bring together the various pieces of knowledge woven together into one piece, so that we can look at it all together and find out what all of these other hydroluminaries, these other experts in the various aspects of water, having gone in depth in their area, how it all weaves together. For people listening, what are three or four or five awarenesses or takeaways that will make a difference?
Yeah, so for themselves, and we talked about a little bit of this, you know, the idea that you should buy things that last, because if you end up buying something that doesn't last, you're going to end up you're going to throw it away. It's going to end up in a landfill. We talked about recycling. I always say, you know, for the general population, read your water bill. You know, in business, there's a saying that says you can't manage what you don't measure. And so your water meter is a good place to start in an effort to conserve water. So look at your water bill and, you know, play a little game with yourself. See, hey, I spent this much water on my water last month. Can I reduce it a bit? And that's a little game that you can have a better understanding. The big part, it's like anything else. If you own a house, the biggest part of the water that you use would be in your garden. On your lawn. So, you know, that's the area that you could probably make the most effect. We talked about eat more vegetables, buy things that last, conserve electricity. You know, by turning off the light switch, you're saving water because it takes water to, you know, produce the coal or the oil or whatever fuel is fueling your electric plant in your area, natural gas, whatever it is. So if you conserve electricity, you conserve water. Recycle, we talked about that, and drive less. Those are the things, those are the number of things I tell the average person on World Water Day to how to conserve. And the other thing, Steve, I'd say is to the listeners, I'm always writing about water issues on LinkedIn. That's kind of my platform of choice. So if you want to connect with me, go on LinkedIn, Jim Lauria, L-A-U-R-I-A. You'll see me on there. You won't miss me. It'll talk all about my water aspects.
Thank you, Jim Lauria, for a wonderful conversation. This is Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki, and we'll be back with you next week.